Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're wading into, well, a pretty complex situation. The U.S. real estate market.
Yeah.
It's definitely in a period of flux.
That's putting it mildly, yeah.
We've got sources looking at the big picture for commercial real estate, but also a specific snapshot of retail from Q1 2025.
Right, quite a mix.
Our mission here is to pull out the key insights for you, the learner. We're especially looking at the distressed side. Think office buildings, multifamily housing, trying to help you see the landscape, maybe spot some opportunities without getting totally overwhelmed.
Okay, sounds good. And it really is a tale of different sectors right now. As you said, commercial office, that's facing some serious headwinds nationally.
Yeah, that seems like the big story.
But then multifamily housing, it's much more varied, depends heavily on where you look. And all this is happening while interest rates are still, you know, stubbornly high, even with those Fed adjustments last year.
Right. Let's dive into the office buildings first. It seems like ground zero for a lot of the turbulence, the whole shift to remote and hybrid work since the pandemic. That's really the catalyst, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's fundamental. Companies are realizing they just don't need the same amount of space. And frankly, they're being drawn to newer buildings.
Better amenities.
Yeah.
Maybe better deals, too.
Exactly. With so much space available, tenants have leverage, especially when looking at, say, Class A buildings versus older stock. We saw the national office vacancy rate hit, 19.8% by the end of 2024?
Almost 20%. Wow. Nearly one in five offices just sitting empty. That's stark.
It is stark. And it's not just older buildings or suburban locations, though they're often hit harder. It points towards a potential, you know, long-term reshaping of what the office market even looks like.
And it's more than just empty space, right?
Yeah.
The financial pressure on the landlords must be immense.
Oh, it is. Because even though the Fed cut rates a bit in 24, commercial mortgage rates didn't really follow suit in a big way. They're still elevated.
Still expensive to borrow.
Very. And landlords are also facing rising operating costs, utilities, maintenance, taxes, you name it. We're hearing cases where the rent coming in barely covers those costs before they even think about paying the mortgage.
Oof. So that's got to crush property values.
It does. It puts clear downward pressure, which then makes refinancing, well, a massive challenge when those loans mature.
So logic would say, wave of foreclosures, distressed sales hitting the market. But the sources suggest that hasn't really happened. Not on a huge scale, anyway. What's going on there?
It's this weird kind of standoff, you know? A lot of owners are just holding on, maybe hoping the market turns around, hoping values recover. Buyers, meanwhile, might be waiting, thinking prices could fall further.
And the banks.
And the lenders, yeah. They're often hesitant. Foreclosing is messy. Managing these properties is costly, complex, especially when you're competing with brand new buildings. So they're reluctant to officially recognize those losses on their books.
So everyone's kind of waiting each other out, a delicate balance.
Very delicate. But it means that when deals do happen, they're often these highly distressed situations or forced sales. And that, unfortunately, can pull overall pricing down even more. It's a tough cycle.
Hmm. But it's not all doom and gloom everywhere. I think one source mentioned New York City seeing a big jump in office leasing.
That's right. A really significant increase. Actually, almost 50% from October 23 to October 24. It really highlights that you can't paint the whole country with the same brush.
So why NYC? Just a stronger return to office push there. Different industries.
It could be a mix of things. Certain sectors demanding in-person work, maybe the sheer scale and draw of New York.
Mm.
It shows that strong urban cores, especially for top-tier properties, might have a different trajectory.
That's a crucial point. Location, property class. It all matters. And you mentioned the return to office push. Some employers are getting stricter about that, aren't they?
They are. That trend is definitely growing, wanting people back full time. That could certainly help absorb some of that vacant space over time.
And there's another angle to converting offices to apartments. I saw New York is looking at rezoning for that.
Yes, that's a really interesting development. Given how incredibly tight New York's housing market is, I think the source said vacancy was just 1.4% in October 24.
Wow, 1.4%.
Yeah, and a shortage of something like 500,000 homes.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got this massive oversupply of office space potentially and this huge undersupply of housing. The logic for conversion seems pretty compelling there.
So for you, the learner, listening,
yeah,
maybe there's a real opportunity there, taking empty offices and turning them into needed homes. If you can navigate the complexities, of course.
It's definitely an area smart investors are looking at closely. Now, if we switch gears to multifamily housing, the picture gets, well, fuzzier, less uniform distress than an office.
Right, more regional variation, the sources said. The Northeast seems to be holding up pretty well.
Yeah, rent growth there has been quite strong, actually. New York City, again, median asking rent was up 2.1% year over year as of October 24.
What's keeping it strong there? Just not enough building. Steady demand.
Probably a combination. Limited new supply coming online in some of those established markets, stable local economies, and just persistent demand for rental units.
But other places, not so rosy. There was talk about potential rent declines because of a construction boom that started during the pandemic. Sounds like some cities might get swamped with new apartments.
Exactly. And where that new supply is concentrated is key. Austin, Texas is the example given. Median rent there dropped significantly. From about $4,480 in August 24 down to $1,394 by December 24. That's a year-over-year drop of nearly 18%. Almost unheard of previously.
18% drop. Okay, so that really shows how localized this can be. Too much building in one spot can really hit rents hard.
Absolutely. Supply and demand right down to the neighborhood level sometimes.
Yet, despite those headwinds in places like Austin, the sources suggest investors are still buying multifamily, and it might even be a preferred asset in 2025. How does that square?
It suggests investors are being selective. They see the fundamental need for housing long term, but they're likely focusing on specific markets, maybe specific property types, workforce housing, for example, that seem more stable or have better growth prospects than, say, luxury high-rises in an overbuilt area.
Okay, so diligence and local knowledge are absolutely critical there.
Always, but especially now.
Let's talk about the lenders again for a second.
Yeah.
Banks and other lenders. What's their general strategy in this market?
Well, the sense is they're trying to reduce their overall commercial real estate holdings where they can. The old playbook of foreclosing and trying to fix up a struggling property, it's just less attractive now.
Why is that? More expensive.
More expensive, definitely more complicated. You're competing with newer buildings. Tenant demand might be lower. It's harder to turn those assets around successfully. So, frankly, they'd rather just avoid having these underperforming loans on their books if possible.
Okay. So if banks are maybe reluctant to foreclose, how do investors actually get into these distressed deals? What are the main ways?
There are a few key routes. You can buy the property directly from an owner who's in trouble, maybe before it even gets to foreclosure. You can buy at a foreclosure auction if one does happen, or through a bankruptcy sale.
Right.
And another really significant way, as mentioned in the source, is buying the loan itself from the lender, usually at a discount.
Buying the debt. Okay, why would an investor do that? What's the advantage?
The big advantage is you get to reset the basis. If you buy the loan for, say, 70 cents on the dollar, your investment is based on that lower amount, which reflects the property's current reality.
Right, not the inflated value from years ago.
Precisely. And then you have options. You can try to work with the existing borrower, negotiate new terms, maybe provide some flexibility. That's a loan workout. Or if that doesn't work, you can proceed with foreclosure yourself, but from a much stronger financial position because you bought the debt cheap.
Got it. Now, foreclosure and bankruptcy. They sound legally complex. The source breaks down a few types. Mortgage foreclosure, UCC foreclosure, bankruptcy sales. Can you give us the quick version of the differences?
Sure. So mortgage foreclosure is what most people think of. The lender takes back the actual real estate because the mortgage wasn't paid. The process varies by state. Some are faster, non-judicial states, maybe a few months. Others, like New York, are judicial, meaning it involves lawsuits and courts and can take, you know, a year or even two.
Okay, quite a difference. What about UCC?
UCC foreclosure is a bit different. It targets the ownership interest in the company that owns the property, like the shares in the LLC. It's governed by the Uniform Commercial Code, hence UCC. It's typically much faster, maybe 30 to 90 days.
Faster, okay. Any catches?
A key thing is the lender can credit bid, basically bid using the debt they're owed. But importantly, whoever buys through a UCC sale usually takes on all the debts tied to that ownership entity, the mortgage, any other liens, taxes, everything.
So you inherit all the problems potentially. And bankruptcy sales?
Those happen within a bankruptcy case, overseen by a judge. Can be voluntary, where the borrower agrees, or involuntary. A big potential plus for buyers here is the chance to get the property free and clear of existing lenants, which the court can approve. Sometimes faster timelines, too.
Free and clear. That sounds appealing.
It can be, but bankruptcy has its own complexities, of course.
So lots of different paths, each with its own rules and risks. If you're buying the actual property through one of these methods, what are the big legal things to watch out for?
Number one, Properties are almost always sold as is, where is, very limited promises or warranties from the seller. So your own due diligence is absolutely crucial.
Meaning
thorough inspections, environmental checks, and especially getting good title insurance and doing a full title search to uncover any liens or claims against the property. You don't want surprises later.
Right. No hidden problems.
Exactly. Also, be aware that the current owner or other creditors might try to fight or delay the sale in court. And don't forget potential real estate transfer taxes, which can be significant depending on the location.
Okay, that's for buying the property. What if you're buying the loan instead? What are the key legal checks there?
Your focus is heavily on the loan documents themselves, the note, the mortgage, any guarantees. Are they correctly drafted, enforceable? You also still need thorough lien and title searches on the underlying property.
Even though you're just buying the paper.
Absolutely, because the property is the collateral securing that paper. You need to know what you'd be getting if you eventually had to foreclose. A challenge can be getting physical access to inspect the property before buying the loan. That's often limited.
Makes sense. So you need protection in the deal itself.
Yes. You want strong protections in your loan purchase agreement. Things like representations and warranties from the selling lender about the loan status. Maybe an indemnification clause to cover you if certain things turn out not to be true.
It definitely sounds like you need good advisors, lawyers, financial experts to navigate this.
100%. This is not a DIY space. The source even lays out some key rules for investing here.
What are the main takeaways from those rules?
First, really understand the local market. National trends are one thing, but real estate is local. Analyze how the specific property is doing compared to its competitors. Second, exhaustive due diligence. Look for over-leverage, bad management, hidden liabilities, regulatory issues. Dig deep.
Don't just look at the surface.
Never. Third, know what you don't know. Get experienced professional advice. And finally, understand the nuts and bolts of these distressed transactions, how they work, what can go wrong, what your worst case scenario might be.
Solid advice. Okay, so that covers the distressed commercial side pretty well. But we also have that other report, the one on the retail real estate market for Q1 2025. Sounds like a different story altogether.
It is, yeah. A contrasting picture. While office has these deep structural shifts happening, retail seems to be more softening, facing broader economic headwinds.
Softening how? What did the Q1 data show?
It showed negative net absorption, meaning more space became vacant than was leased up. About 5.9 million square feet nationally. That's actually the weakest quarter for retail since the start of the pandemic.
Negative absorption. So demand actually shrank in Q1. What's driving that?
A big factor highlighted is tariffs on imported goods. The expectation is that these will raise costs for retailers.
Which they might pass on to consumers.
Exactly. Which could lead to higher prices, maybe dampen consumer spending. It also just creates uncertainty for retailers trying to plan inventory, staffing, investment. The report notes consumer sentiment actually dipped pretty low in early April 25 because of these tariff worries.
Okay, so tariffs are casting a shadow. Is that showing up in vacancy rates too?
Yes. The national retail vacancy rate ticked up slightly to 5.5% in Q1. Still relatively low historically, but up a bit year over year. It seems neighborhood shopping centers saw the biggest hit in terms of occupancy loss.
And rents. Are landlords having to cut rents in retail?
Asking rents were still up slightly year over year, about 2.3% on average nationally. But that growth rate has definitely slowed down.
So the upward momentum is fading.
It seems so. With stores closing, the report expects closures to outpace openings and tenants facing those higher costs. You'd expect more pressure on rent growth going forward. Landlords might have less pricing power.
So maybe a tougher time for retail landlords, but does that mean opportunities for tenants?
Potentially, yes. If you're a retailer negotiating a new lease or a renewal, you might find landlords are a bit more flexible, offering better terms or concessions.
Interesting. So the dynamic is shifting. What's the overall outlook for retail then, according to this report?
The outlook is cautious. The market was already cooling a bit before the tariff news, which adds another layer of risk. Retailers themselves are maybe better prepared for disruption after dealing with the pandemic, but it's still a headwind.
And vacancy. Will it keep climbing?
It might tick up further. The forecast mentioned potentially reaching 6.0% to 6.5% by early 2026. But one thing limiting a huge spike is that new construction is pretty constrained because building costs are so high.
So not a flood of new supply coming online to make things worse.
Right, that could help stabilize things. And beyond early 2026, if the economy strengthens, maybe things pick up again. But near term, It's a cooler environment.
And like with multifamily, I assume retail performance varies a lot by region and type of center, too.
Oh, definitely. The report likely breaks down those differences. Some markets doing better, some worse. Power centers versus malls versus neighborhood strips, they all have slightly different dynamics. Granular data is key there, too.
Okay, this has been incredibly insightful. So let's try to wrap this up. The U.S. real estate market, definitely a mixed bag right now.
That's the main theme, yes.
We've got major distress in commercial office, driven by remote work and financial pressures. But that distress might create opportunities, especially these office-to-resi conversions.
Right, a sector undergoing a real transformation.
Then multifamily, much more varied, some areas strong, others facing oversupply issues from recent construction, requires it a very local focus.
Very regional, very sub-market specific.
And finally, retail is softening. Not the same structural shift as office, but feeling the pinch from economic factors like tariffs, leading to slower rent growth and maybe some opportunities for tenants.
A more cyclical downturn, perhaps, exacerbated by current policy and economic conditions. Each sector really dancing to its own tune.
So as we finish this deep dive, here's a thought to leave you with, the learner. We see these diverging paths, office in distress, retail softening, office to residential gaining traction. Looking ahead, what other maybe unforeseen real estate adaptations might emerge? As work, shopping, and living patterns keep shifting, could we see completely new types of hybrid spaces? Or maybe totally different ways of repurposing buildings we haven't even thought of yet? What's the next big adaptation? Something to ponder.
Definitely a space to watch. The only constant seems to be change.
Indeed. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.